we now have a hymn number 42. So now we have those on to speak to us on the second part of our study under the general heading of God's design and the creation of the world, and part two, the woman, the glory of the man. Now before we have our reading to introduce that, can we have a show of hands if we haven't got two readings to introduce a second study? We have 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verses 1 to 12. So that's 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and the first 12 verses. Sorry, look for our goes on to speak to us, woman, the glory of the man.
Sisters and our young people, certainly is a delightful day that Yahweh has turned on for us today, and I'm sure that with the natural world that we see about us and that new spiritual world that we look forward to, that we have many good things to think about today. I do think that our two studies this morning, I have found personally in preparing them over the years to be some of the most helpful and practical that we've come across. Very often when we think that we study the Old Testament scriptures like the books of Genesis, that it's very historical material, rather dry, and it's so old that it's really unrelated to the modern world in which we live. But in fact, the basic study which we did last night looking at the creation of man, and the one this morning which follows on from it, which is the formation of woman, are very, very modern. They apply in all generations, in all circumstances of life. And in fact, they set forward before us the only basis by which we can have a happy and successful life now and, of course, in the kingdom to come. Last night, we endeavoured to set out the basis of God's purpose as it relates to the divine family. I didn't have this particular transparency. In fact, it's not one that I normally use with Elpis Israel. It's one that I prepared for a series of studies on the work of the angels, but I think it does set out in a very simple and yet in many ways quite a profound way what we were trying to say last night. That God's purpose is to develop on the earth a divine family, every one of whom shall ultimately be spirit. That is, it will be an immortal family. And so the family consists of the one at the top of this family tree, which we might style the Father. In relationship to this term, the Father, he has a son, who is called the Son of God. In relation to this terminology then, we find then that the heavenly family is divided into two parts. As the Apostle Paul said in writing to the Ephesians in his prayer, "For this cause I bow my knee before the Father, of whom the whole family in heaven and in earth is named." And so there is a family that's being developed which at the moment has two component parts. The family in heaven we can call the sons of God in heaven, such as we have in Job 38 verse 7, where it speaks about the sons of God rejoicing at the time of creation. On the other hand, if we come across to this side, we find that there is another part of that family developing upon earth. At this stage, those who have been baptized are called the children of God, in the terms of Romans chapter 8, verse 16. But these children who have been baptized into the Lord Jesus Christ are waiting for what the Apostle calls in Romans 8, verse 19, the manifestation of the sons of God on earth. Now, I don't want to, at this stage, develop the difference between these two terms. It will get us right away from our topic this morning. But the essential feature is that whilst we are children now, and we are waiting for the full manifestation of sonship, the time will come when these two components of the divine family will be united in one. And that will take place when the words of Zechariah 14, verse 9 are fulfilled, which words say, "And Yahweh shall be king over all the earth. In that day there shall be one Yahweh and his name one." So whilst we trace down that chart, looking at the terms Father, Son, and Sons of God and Children of God, we could take another line which we also have there. The title which we particularly looked at last night was the title Hail, which the Eternal Spirit, the Father, sometimes appropriates to himself. And he would use this particular title when he is speaking of some particular work that's going to be performed. A work which requires power. Remember the three types of power that were manifested? Creative, manipulative, or destructive. So as the source of that power, he is Emmanuel. There was a very particular sense in which the Son of God was Emmanuel, that is, Hail with us. And then, of course, when we come down to the sons of God in heaven, they are Elohim. So let's follow the word Hail through. Hail, the Father, Emmanuel, that is, Hail with us in the sense of the Son, and Elohim, the Mighty Ones, or as we sometimes call them, the angels. And of course, as we know, that it is our privilege that we might one day be called the Elohim of the future age, the Elohim of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Another extension to that is that the Father has appropriated to himself a name. Eil, we would call a title. The name is Yahweh. Yahweh manifested in the Son is Yahshua, or as we sometimes have it in the Greek, Jesus. Yahweh shall save, or the salvation of Yahweh. It's got two parts. It's got the word Yah in there, and the idea of salvation. And so when God's work in the earth is complete, then in that day, the family name will be complete. Because we've been baptized into the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of his power as seen in the Holy Spirit. And therefore, when God's purpose is complete, it can be said, there will be one Yahweh and his name one. Now that transparency isn't actually in the book, but it's a fairly simple one, and I think in its basic elements we can all remember what it says. But this is the point that we were trying to make last night, that God's purpose is a purpose that involves the development of a family. Now because of that, he wants us to understand how family life should be in the natural sense today. Because it's a bit like when the Apostle Paul wrote to the Ephesians. He found a lot of problems in that ecclesia, as he did when he wrote to the Colossians and to others. And many of those problems were very, very basic. There were people saying, I worship my heavenly master. I serve my heavenly master. And yet they couldn't do an honest day's work for their earthly master. And Paul's saying, if you don't know how to do an honest day's work for your earthly master, how can you talk about serving your heavenly master? They were saying, we love our heavenly Father. And yet there were children and young people who were not giving respect to their earthly parents. And of course, the greatest of all relationships, the one in which we see Yahweh as the heavenly bridegroom, who will send his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, to take to himself his bride, and we say we are waiting for that time of the marriage of the Lamb, and yet there are people on earth who can't live an ordinary, reasonable, married life based upon the principles of God's Word. And so as we often say, as with the natural, so with the spiritual. Don't let anybody think that they can serve their heavenly master, father, or bridegroom successfully, and yet they can't do it in their natural setting. Now, I realise there can be difficulties. I realise that times two people might be married and one party might come into the truth and the other one doesn't. There are always these exceptions to the rule. But this morning, we are going to look at what is sometimes called the divine ideal, that which we must aim for. And we're going to be considering this morning that very important relationship which exists between the man and the woman. You know, we mentioned the three relationships that Paul has in Ephesians. And I think when we first come to a knowledge of God, the first thing we see him is as, the first thing we see him as is a master, one to be served. And then as we come to know him better, we see him as a father who is begetting in us a new creature by the power of his word. And that draws us closer to him. But the closest possible relationship that human nature can ever understand is that relationship between a husband and a wife. And therefore, when we ultimately come to realize that Yahweh and his son represent that heavenly bridegroom, the one day we're going to be married to, we've got to learn the basic principles that were involved when God first created the man, and then out of that man he formed the woman, and then from that he extended a relationship which would exist ultimately between other men and women in the natural sense, but that it was to be the basis of a beautiful spiritual principle that would be seen when ultimately the marriage of the Lamb comes. And so this morning then, that's what we want to look at. Before we actually start on that, I said we'd do our little bit of colouring in. And that we will do, just to highlight perhaps the main features from last night. And for those who either perhaps weren't here or maybe arrived a little late, or for those who even found it a little bit complex last night, because we did cover quite a bit of area and we diverged a little bit at times, these are the three things we want to remember from last night. Here are our three terms: image, likeness, and nature. And that we found was on page, what of the notes? Fairly early in the book. Yes. It's the bottom half of the transparency on page 20. So what you've got there is the same as what you've got on the screen. And there are our three words. And if even if the youngest of us here can just take away those three words, in fact, you know, if that's all you take away from this weekend, to our youngest, that is, then I think that could be very, very important. Very important. Image means bodily shape. We've been made to look like the angels, the Elohim. There's nothing we can do about that which actually will enhance the development of our character. So we've got the bodily shape. The third point is a nature. A nature a little lower than the angels. That is, we are subject to death. We die, the angels die no more, we're told in Luke 20, verse 36. The question is, how to get from an image which looks like the Elohim, but has a nature lower than them, but will one day be made equal to them, then it's what we do with this middle bit in here. Likeness. Had some interesting discussions this morning around this word likeness. We would mention that we're talking about it in terms of the Old Testament word. When you go across to the New Testament, you will find the words image and likeness used there. They, of course, come from the Greek. And whilst in general terms they are the same, they do not apply quite so specifically as here. In fact, generally, they're given a spiritual application. So what we're saying here is, the reference to these words, particularly in Hebrew, and particularly in relation to the story of Genesis. And in that context, we saw that the word likeness referred to a mental and moral capacity. And this morning, we've, as a result of a night's sleep, filled up our capacity a little more because there's actually some water in it that wasn't there last night. It's only about three quarters filled. We'll try to fill it up by the end of the day. But you remember our lesson. That cup is like our capacity up here. We've got to fill it up with the word
And we've got to, in so doing, displace the thinking of the flesh. So I'm going to say it is entirely what we do with this that determines whether this bodily shape here will ever come to look like the angels. Now, when people make dogmatic, all-embracing statements like entirely, I think you'd be very wise to sit back and say, oh, is that exaggerating a little bit? But I don't mind if you do that. So I said it has to do entirely with what we do with our mental and moral capacity. To which someone might say, well, are you saying then that the truth is just an academic thing and that it's all knowledge? No, I'm not saying that. The truth is a way of life. But the way we act is directly related to the way we think and to the way that our emotions are governed by our thinking. It's no good thinking. It's no good, I want to use a different word, it's no good imagining that we can do the right thing if we don't know the right thing. So it's only to the extent that we know the truth and we love the truth that, of course, it will be shown in our way of life, which I've generally described here as a character. So there it is. It's entirely related to this. And the one word, the word which we're going to pick up this morning, which summarizes this, is the word glory. All right? And we mentioned last night that the word glory had relationship to the character, the purpose, the name of God. Okay, just to tidy up from last night, the section we dealt with last night in Elpis Israel actually came from two parts. When we dealt with the use of the plural word Elohim, that actually came from a section on page 181. And I would suggest that's probably one of the more difficult sections in the book, and we dealt with it very, very quickly last night. But you might like to highlight one or two sections from the chapter. Well, I suppose it's not a chapter, it's a portion of a chapter, but on page 181, there's a title, Dissertation on the Elohim, right? Now, it's up to you as to whether you do actually colour in your book. I never believe in saying to people, you've got to write something in your book or you've got to do anything anywhere. But if you wish to highlight it or colour it in, I'll tell you the parts that I think are a good summary, which will enable you to come back and pick up the main features later on. The first two lines read, the principles of universal grammar require in general that a verb agree with its nominative in number and person. Now, if you highlight that, that will be a reminder to you of the basis of what we were talking last night about the plural Elohim. Coming across to page 182, come to the bottom paragraph on the page, and the first 6 lines and 3 words. That will read this. A first principle with me in all reasonings upon this subject is that there is one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in all, his spiritual family. Another axiom is that he is the blessed and only potentate, the King of kings, and Lord of Lords, who only hath immortality, dwelling in the light which no man can approach unto, whom no man hath seen nor can see. Alright? Over to the top of page 183. The first paragraph and the first sentence in the next paragraph. These are the bits that you might like to highlight. No man, says Jesus, has seen God at any time. But Adam, Abraham, Jacob, and Moses saw the Elohim and their Lord. Therefore, Elohim does not necessarily mean the everlasting Father himself. Okay, so talking to our very youngest ones, can you remember that from last night? We've got the Father or Ael at the top. But Elohim does not necessarily mean the everlasting Father himself. It is going to be Ael in, what's our word? In, first question for the morning, in manifestation. Alright, so it's going to be God manifest. First sentence of the next paragraph says, Elohim is a name bestowed on angels and orders of men. We didn't develop that in any detail, but you'll find plenty of information in Elpis Israel and also on page 18 and 19 of the little booklet, there is quite a reasonable summary of that section in Ilkis Israel. Down to the next paragraph, page 183, and this is the section which we could highlight. Those to whom the word of God came through Moses are styled Elohim, as it is written, I have said, ye are Elohim, and all of you children of the Most High, but you shall die like men and fall like one of the princes. And then the beginning of the next paragraph, furthermore, it is a well-established principle of the sacred writings that what the everlasting Father does by his agents, he is considered as doing himself. Now, setting our aim at what we might call the youngest, you come back in a week's time and just read those bits that you've highlighted. I think that gives you a sufficiently good summary for a first time through in Ilkis Israel. And really, I think any of us coming to Ilkis Israel, or none of us coming to Ilkis Israel, would ever understand all its depth the first time through. And there are brethren who've read it through many, many times, and they say that each time they come to it, they see something new there. But we've got to start somewhere. And so I think perhaps those points that we highlighted there would be an adequate coverage of the subject of the plural Elohim. Any comments on that? Because I haven't stopped for a breath yet this morning, have I? All right. Marking up Ilkis Israel can also be a family project, and if the children are particularly young and you leave it on the table, it can end up looking like that as well, which it's not meant to. I think actually they knew what they were doing because they went to the index first to find out which pages they should turn up. For those who can't see it, it's all vertical sort of things. So we come back then to the section which was the actual title last night. That is Man in the Image and Likeness of the Elohim, page 37. Although we didn't deal with it in our class, and we've set a very, very limited project this weekend in just doing five studies, although we didn't cover this, I really think that the bottom of page 37 is worth highlighting so that when you come back to it, you might see that it is really significant, even though we didn't cover it. So it's the section which says, bottom of page 37, men and beasts, say the scriptures, have all one ruach or spirit, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast. The reason assigned for this equality is the oneness of their spirit, which is proved by the fact of their common destiny, as it is written, for all are vanity, that is, all go unto one place, all are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. Yet this one spirit manifests its tendencies differently in men and other creatures. In the former it is aspiring and God-defying, rejoicing in its own works and devoted to the vanity of the passing hour, while in the latter its disposition is grovelling to the earth in all things. The reason I want you to highlight that is because we're going to pick that up in our next study this morning, God willing, as the basis of that study. Right, over on page 38. Three lines is all we need to do on page 38, and two and a half lines on page 39, and that would summarise last night. Second paragraph down. Well, it depends whether you include the first one or not. It's about halfway down the page. Page 38, there's a paragraph starts off with these words. Man, however, differs from other creatures in having been modelled after a divine type or pattern. In form and capacity, he was made like to the angels, though in nature inferior to them. And by this stage, you've heard that so many times, you could probably recite it off. But after all, that's the summary of what we were talking about. And over on page 39, down to the middle of the page, beginning of, well, almost the beginning of that paragraph, there's a paragraph there which says Seth was also in Adam's own likeness. Don't necessarily have to highlight that bit at the moment. But the next bit, while image then hath reference to form or shape, likeness has regard to mental constitution or capacity. So there it is. Back to our summary again. You will excuse the repetition, but I think it's important that we get these points in our mind. Image, likeness, and nature. There are our three terms. So image then has reference to form or shape. Likeness has regard to mental constitution or capacity. For those who aren't really familiar with El Padusra, we ought to give you a little clue here. And that is, whenever a word is written in italics, you know italics, sloping letters, that means you've got to take a note of it, because it's an important word. You might just notice there that the word image and likeness are both in italics. As in that previous section, the words form, capacity, and nature were in italics. What it means is that Brother Thomas is saying, I want you to note that word for one of two reasons. Either I used that word somewhere before, and I want you to remember that I used it before, or I'm going to use it again shortly, and I want you to remember it then. And shortly might mean 40 pages later, as I can think of in one instance. And certainly, some of these terms here, like capacity, are going to come up in our next study, which is going to be page 88. 39, 49, 59, 69, 79. Well, that's nearly 50 pages later. If I counted that right, did I get it right? Yes. So, you've got to remember these words in italics. And that's the clue. So, emphatic words are in italics. In fact, occasionally, but very, very rarely, he will actually put a word completely in uppercase. In capitals, and that's an extra special emphasis, but they only come occasionally. Well, that was just really a review of last night. Any questions? No? All right. And also, Adrian, you weren't here earlier. When are you going to practice that? During the coffee break. All right, so Hebrew alphabet will come up later in the morning. Now, this morning, as you would have picked up from 1 Corinthians 11, we've read the words of the Apostle Paul, which we would call an inspired commentary on the story of Genesis. However, we will go back to Genesis initially, and we're going to pick up the story as it was recorded in the first place, and as it has relationship to the subject entitled The Formation of Woman, which, as far as Elpis Israel is concerned, is the chapter starting on page 47. So it's page 47 of Elpis Israel, Genesis 2 in the Bible. Right, Genesis chapter 2, and we can pick it up from verse 18. We're bearing in mind all of the things that we read about last night. Genesis 2, verse 18. And Yahweh Elohim said, it is not good that the man should be alone. I will make a help fit for him. The question is, why was it not good that the man should be alone? Well, there's our question. Why wasn't it good? I guess that's true. Yes, I wouldn't dispute that. Could we take it a bit further than that, perhaps? I guess you're saying that on the basis that in the next couple of verses it says he looked around amongst the animals to look for a partner for the man. We'll have a look at that in a moment. Let's take a step back. What was God's purpose in creating the man? In simple terms. Yes? We don't quite know what that means yet until our next study. So, can you give me another answer? That's not a wrong answer, but it's just not the one that I'm looking for. Yes, okay. To manifest his glory. Now, we can agree with that, can't we, in a general sense. That covers all of them. Man was created to manifest the glory of God. What's the glory of God? The glory of God is synonymous with his... What terms? What other terms? His character, that's right. I've got a transparency here. I might even do that under another series, but see if I can... Ah, no, it's not. In German, that's right. We used it in the Roman study. Never mind. God's glory is synonymous with God's character. That's correct. How would you describe God's character? Can you think of a passage in the Bible that describes God's character? Think of the incident of Moses. Moses said to Yahweh, "Show me thy glory." Where's that? Where's that question? Show me thy glory. Exodus 33 and verse 18. Right, Exodus 33 verse 18. Moses pleads with Yahweh, "I beseech thee, show me thy glory." The answer he received was, "I will make all my goodness pass before thee, and I will proclaim the name of Yahweh before thee." So see how it's linking the two ideas together. My name and my glory are synonymous terms. Synonymous, is that all right? Not too big a word? Similar ideas, aren't they? Glory and goodness and name. So when we come to chapter 34, we read then in verse 5 that Yahweh descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of Yahweh. Now, in proclaiming the name of Yahweh, he didn't just say Yahweh. He pronounced the name, but then he expanded on that by saying, embodied in my name, there is my character. Because my name and my character are synonymous terms. So notice what we read then in verse 6 and 7. Exodus 34, verses 6 and 7. Yahweh passed by before him and proclaimed, "Yahweh, Yahweh, El, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, and that will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and upon the children's children, unto the third and to the fourth generation." Now, there's a listing of a number of characteristics. But in other places of the Bible, that's sometimes summarized into two terms. We can think of some of the examples in the New Testament, perhaps, where God's character is summarized in two words. You can put an and between it if you like to make it three words. Goodness and severity. Let's list some of these up on here. Ooh. Where do we find goodness and severity? So that's found in Romans 11:22. So we've got goodness and severity. Any others? Mercy and judgment. I'll put it up. Can you think of a quote? Mercy and judgment. There is a quote, isn't it? It says that mercy rejoices against judgment. Okay, you look that one up in Strong's. Yes, it's a viable one, valid one. There is a quote that says that, and that's the writer is going to find it. Got another one? Jealous. Yes, but that's only, that's giving us an aspect of Yahweh's attitude to his people. We're looking for this one which shows that the character is, if you like, a balance. Balance isn't perhaps the best of the words, but it's this aspect of goodness, mercy, forgiveness, that type of thing. On the other hand, severity, judgment, and so forth. So by no means plead the guilty. I've got another one. Grace and truth in John 1:14. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. So you see, down this side then, and of course we've got all of those other terms in Exodus, merciful, we've got mercy up there, yes, merciful, gracious, long-suffering, let's put them all down here, long-suffering, that's a very important one, by the way, because Peter says God's long-suffering is our salvation. You know, there's a difference between condoning sin or compromising and long-suffering. Long-suffering is a divine attribute. Just tolerating evil or compromising in the truth is not a divine one. And sometimes when we're in an environment where things aren't going quite right, and sometimes you say we've got to leave or we've got to disfellowship, well, maybe sometimes we do, but we must be very careful, because sometimes there are other ways of handling problems, and we must sometimes take a long-range view and say it will be better to do it this way. Just mention that one, because that's a very important one. Long-suffering is actually a divine attribute if it's handled properly. Anyway, we'll just mention that. Goodness, mercy, grace, long-suffering. What did it say? Just picking up those ones from Exodus 34 then, abundant in goodness and truth, giving mercy for thousands, forgiving ignorance. All right, that will do. On the other hand, that will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers, etc. Not clear guilty and visiting iniquity. But I think you can see the idea. Now, here are two aspects of God's character which we often say are balanced off one against the other. Now, let's go back to Genesis. God has just created a man. And he says, I want this man to show forth my glory. I want this man to reveal my character. What aspects of God's character would it be totally impossible for him to manifest if he was the only human being on the face of the earth? And we're not talking about the earth being populated simply with men and not women. At this stage, there's only one man. And God says, I want him to show forth my glory. I'm going to suggest that it would be absolutely impossible for him to manifest one side of God's character. Which side is it? It's got to be this side here, doesn't it? You see, his life can be very sort of academic. It can be very mechanical. Brother Thomas expresses it beautifully when he says, a purely intellectual and abstractly moral society, untempered by domesticism, is an imperfect state. It may be very enlightened. It may be very dignified and immaculate. But it would also be very formal and frigid as the poles. So his life would have been a purely mechanical life. Now, I don't want you to start rushing ahead in your thoughts and saying, that means to say that if a man never gets married, he's going to turn out like that. Well, it might. Stop laughing, Stephen. I haven't looked at you yet. It doesn't mean that at all. Well, let's say it doesn't necessarily mean that. The Lord Jesus Christ was never married. The Apostle Paul was never married. And of course, our whole association together in ecclesial life enables us to assist each other in the development of these characters. But we're talking at this stage about one man only on the face of the earth. His life would be totally wrapped up in himself. All he had to think about is, I will get up in the morning when I feel like getting up. I will go to bed when I feel like going to bed. I will do things when I want to do. It will be a very orderly existence. As Brother Thomas puts it so beautifully, it would be intellectual. It would be abstractly moral. Abstract. You know, it's not concrete. He would talk about morals. Oh, he'd be able to talk about mercy and grace and long-suffering, but it'd mean nothing. Who is he extending mercy to? Because, you see, the word mercy, particularly the word as defined in the Bible, means that there is one party who is in need of something, and there is another party who has the ability to satisfy that need. The Greek word eleos in the New Testament is so defined by Vine in his dictionary. It requires a need on the part of one person and the ability to satisfy that need on the other part, a part of the other person. And we'll come back to that word in a moment, because it's a lot more than just saying, look, I feel sorry for you. I'd like to do something to help. It means I've got the ability to help. You've got the need, I've got the ability. So you see, Adam could have theorized about all of this, but it wouldn't have developed the character until it was put into practice. So we're back in Genesis 2 again, and we come back to our question. Yahweh Elohim said, it is not good that the man should be alone. I will make a help fit for him. Now here's the question again. Why wasn't it good that God should... Why wasn't it good that man should be alone? Because, left to himself, he could only... I don't have to answer the whole question. Just yes. Right. No, I don't like to do it. Only people that I feel safe on picking on, like you, Adrian. Oh, it's not all that safe down the front, are we? Sorry? He couldn't form a character. Or more particularly, he could only develop one side of that. And really, one side of a character isn't a character, is it? I mean, it's only half a person. So, Yahweh said, I will make a help for him. Now, at the moment, we don't know what this help's going to be. Yes, Brother Thomas comments on that very beautifully, as a matter of fact. If you notice on page 47 there, he says in that opening paragraph, in the very opening words, Adam, having been formed in the image after the likeness of the Elohim on the sixth day, remained for a short time alone in the midst of the earthborns of the field. He had no companion who could reciprocate his intelligence, none who could minister to his wants or rejoice with him in the delights of creation and reflect the glory of his nature. Then, if you'd like to do it while you're at it, I suggest this next part be highlighted. The Elohim are a society rejoicing in the love and attachment of one another. And Adam, being like them, though of inferior nature, required an object which should be calculated to evoke the latent resemblances of his similitude to theirs. So here are the Elohim over here, a community, and we might suggest that in the community of Elohim, there are perhaps the male and female components. It's one of those things that is an interesting topic of discussion. But they are a society, rejoicing in the company with each other. They've now created a man and he's all by himself. Yes, there would be a certain relationship with the Elohim, but it's a sort of relationship that way. There needs to be one that's this way. And therefore, Brother Thomas uses the term, he required an object. Now, it seems a little insulting at the moment to just call the female of the species. Didn't say species over here, did it? Species. We're getting better. Female of the species, object. But you see, at this stage, he's saying it's undefined. Here is the man. What can we form that it might be a help to that man, that he might be able to rejoice with this other object in the delights of creation, and so develop character which will reflect the glory of God? So he required an object which should be calculated to evoke. What's evoke? Evoke. You know, I usually take the opportunity when we've got 12-year-olds in the class of picking up one word each night, and we usually say, well, what other words can you think of that sounds like evoke? And then I'll say provoke, and other words like that. So, evoke, provoke, convoke. What do you get? Convocation, provocation, evocation. What's voke mean? Revocation, Edict of Nantes, and all that sort of thing. Yes. What's voke? Who did Latin? Who did Latin? Put your hand up if you did Latin. What's vox? Vocus or vox? Voice, that's right. So, voke means voice.
Sounds vocal cords, that's quite right, yes.
So, you can get pro, e, con, read, and all these things you see are what they call, what do they call them? It's on the front of a word. Prefixes that go on the front of a word, and the ends can be all sorts of different things. So evoke means to a voice. Yes, the E sort of means out, voice out, call out. It means to draw out anyway, to evoke, to bring out of him. The latent. Latent? What's latent? Hidden. Right. So what it's telling us there is then that Adam required an object which should be calculated to draw out of him the hidden resemblances of his similitude to the angels. So he'd been made like the angels, and he had inside of him the capacity to develop these things, but it needed another object over here to draw it out of him. So what do the Elohim do? Well, we go back to Genesis chapter 2. And we read verses 19 and 20. Out of the ground, Yahweh Elohim formed every beast of the field, and every fowl of the air, and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. And Adam gave names to the fowl of the air and to every beast of the field. But for Adam there was not found an help meet or fit, as the word can be better rendered, for him. Sometimes you hear people talking about women being helpmates. There's not a word called a helpmeet at all. It's a help meet for him. It's actually an old English word. It means a help fit for him. Other translations may make it something like counsel.
There's not a word called a help meet at all. It's a help meet for him. It's actually an old English word. It means a help fit for him. Other translations may make it something like counterpart. We've got our RV and RSV and that around this morning. Russell, what did the RSV? A helper fit for him. That's better English, yes. What about the RV? Helper fit for him. Meat for him. I think it's Rotherham's emphasised Bible that says a counterpart. And you know, the word counterpart is like our word complement. Complement, not compliment. Doesn't mean she's got to go around complimenting him, which means saying nice things. Complement means to fill up, doesn't it? It's the counterpart to. So notice what it's saying. It says that Yahweh Elohim really looked around amongst all the animals and said, we can't find an animal that can perform this role over here. Why couldn't they form an find an animal? Right, that's the positive answer to the question. What I want initially, though, is the negative answer to the question. Why couldn't they? Fine. What was wrong with the animals? We're going to get to that point as the next step along the process, actually. Because I've got two answers at once there. They both said different things, but they both gave the same answer. You said because they didn't have a likeness to the Elohim, because they were, what was the word you said?
Amoral.
Now just tuck that word away, because that's going to be our next study about the carnal mind. At the moment, we just want to leave it with this simple expression, and that is that they did not have the moral capacity that Adam did. They were purely fleshly creatures. They were not created after the image and likeness of the Elohim. Therefore, whilst it's quite possible that many of you have got pets, cats and dogs and a goat and a few things like that, and ducks and geese and fowls and all that sort of thing, and you can have a certain relationship with them in the sense that they're quite nice and very often they do as they're told and sometimes they don't, and you can train them and all of that sort of thing, but you can't have a discussion on the scriptures with them. And I'm not joking when I say that, as silly as it sounds, can you? You can't sit down and do the daily readings with them and expect them to understand it. And as I said, it's so stupid that we automatically laugh. But the fact is that there was no animal that could help that man in the area where he needed help. Yes, you could produce a horse which could pull a plow along, or a cow which would give milk, or a dog that would go out and pick up the morning paper or something like that. You could have all sorts of interaction with animals at a certain level, but nothing to do with developing divine character. Right, now that's the important thing. Our brother Thomas makes this comment, and we've already read it in bits and pieces. I'll just read it again, and it's essentially found on page 47. Formed in the image and after the likeness of the Elohim, Adam, being like them, though of inferior nature, required an object which would be calculated to evoke the latent resemblances of his similitude to theirs. A purely intellectual and abstractly moral society untempered by domesticism is an imperfect state. It may be very enlightened, very dignified and immaculate, but it would also be very formal and frigid as the poles. Hence Yahweh said concerning the man, I will make a help fit for him. I found some of these comments so helpful, I've typed them in on a page in my Bible, actually in Ephesians, because I think that's where the obvious exhortation comes through. But all of those words you should find on page 47, and if you wanted to highlight those, it would be about 5 or 6 lines down from the top, the sentence, the Elohim are a society, going through to similitude to theirs. Miss out 2 or 3 lines and then come down to the one, a purely intellectual and abstractly moral society, to the end of that sentence, and then pick up the last sentence in the paragraph, Yahweh Elohim said it is not good that the man should be alone, I will make a help fit for him. And we have general notes on that in our notes here, but in general terms anyway. So we've got to the stage then where the Elohim look at the animals, to which Brother Thomas comments somewhere, I've got his quote here, so I'll read the quote from the quote. Out of the ground were the animals formed. It was not desirable that the woman should be created on the same basis as the animals, as there would have been about the same kind of attachment between men and women as subsists among the creatures below them. What sort of relationship exists between a male and female lion, for example? And the words we're going to get used to using, we'll write it up here. Let's get used to these terms. I'm sure you've heard before. Mental. Moral, in the sense of emotional. And our three terms. What sort of relationship exists between a male and a female lion? Mental, well, in a very fleshly sort of way, which we'll talk about in our next study. Moral, well, if we're talking about pure morals, absolutely none. Physical, that's the relationship, isn't it? The relationship between animals is essentially physical. It's based upon what Brother Thomas would call the propensities of the flesh, the needs of the flesh. There is no attempt whatsoever for a male and a female lion to develop character. They don't bring up their children with character. They bring up their children to train them how to go out and kill other animals so they can eat and live and subsist. In other words, whilst we might say there's some sort of mental connection, it's very much a fleshly sort of thing. The lion roars. I don't know which one roars, the female, I suppose, does she? Anyway, one roars and the other one answers. And yes, I guess there's some sort of connection. But we can virtually say the relationship between the animals is purely and simply physical. But that wasn't what God was looking for with the male and the female of the species. So he says, the woman's companionship was to be intellectually, there it is, mental, put the word intellectual after that, intellectual. It was to be intellectually and morally, there's a second word, sympathetic with her husband. She was to reflect the glory of man as he reflected the glory of God. Now, where does that come from? She was to reflect the glory of man as he reflected the glory of God. Where's that quote from? 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 7. And that completes the quote from last night.
where Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 7, for the man is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of the man. Now, this is also a very important development in our process, and we will come back to Corinthians 11 before we finish this talk this morning. So, she was created or formed to reflect the glory of man as he reflected the glory of God. So, we read then in verses 21 through to the end of the chapter, that's in Genesis chapter 2, that Yahweh Elohim caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam. He slept. He took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof, and the rib which Yahweh Elohim had taken from man made he a woman and brought her unto the man. So, Brother Thomas comments, it was necessary that the woman be formed out of man, and this necessity is found in the law which pervades the flesh. If one part of the body suffers, all other members suffer with it. Bone sympathizes with bone, and flesh with flesh, in all pleasurable, healthful, and painful experiences. You might like to pick up this next section. It's about two-thirds of the way down, page 48. See the paragraph that starts to give being to such a creature? Got that paragraph? We'll come down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 6 lines and 4 words plus a comma at a full stop, and you should come to the word hence. Hence, to separate a portion of Adam's living substance and from it to build a woman would be to transfer to her the sympathies of Adam's nature, and though by her organisation able to maintain an independent existence, she would never lose from her nature a sympathy with his in all its intellectual, moral, and physical manifestations. Right? So, he says, the relationship between the man and the woman must be first mental, then moral, then physical. Alright? If you just go back to the end of the previous paragraph and count up from the bottom of the previous paragraph, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines and 2 words, this will see who's awake. What's the first word? You lost? What's the first word? And. Very good. Everyone got the word and? Did you get it? Just like this. Alright. You went back 7 lines and 2 words, and then you came to a semicolon. Now listen to this. And I reckon these words ought to be highlighted, underlined, and 2 columns put down in your margin. And that's almost the maximum emphasis you can give to anything in my form of highlighting. In proportion as generations of mankind lose their intellectual and moral likeness to the Elohim and fall under the dominion of sensuality, that's merely the gratifying of the senses, so the sympathy between men and women evaporates into mere animalism. But I say, such a degenerate result as this was not the end of her formation. She was not simply to be the mother of all living. She was not just formed for what you might call animal purposes, for the purpose of the procreation of mankind. That was not the intention absolutely. That was, if you like, incidental. bit like our quote last night, God manifestation, not human salvation. Human salvation is incidental to God's purpose. The procreation of mankind is incidental to it. The reason why God created that one woman for that one man was that they might intellectually, emotionally, and physically become one to the glory of God. She was not simply to be the mother of all living, but to reflect the glory of man as he reflected the glory of God.
Now I want to get rid of all this. I want to put up there simply those three words again. Right, this word can also be intellectual.
I should repeat what I put on the board, shouldn't I, for this microphone's quite blind, isn't it? Yeah.
All right, we've written up here mental, moral, and physical. After the word mental, we put the word intellectual, because that's the one we sometimes use. The word moral can be in emo... It's gone wrong there, hasn't it? Emotional and physical, and in a sense we could put against physical sort of animal in a sense. Now look what Brother Thomas says. As generations of mankind lose their intellectual and moral likeness to the Elohim, what's left? Pure animalism. And what do we see in the world out there today? If Brother Thomas could say that in 1848, what would he say if he was living in the year 1990? He'd only have to look at the world out there. And they've just got animal written all over them, haven't they? And we grow up in a society and we tend to adjust to it. It's good, I suppose, in the sense that human nature can adjust to change, because if it couldn't, then we would remember all of the sadnesses, all of the sorrows, all of the bad things that ever happened, and we would become depressed. So time can be a good healing agent in some respects. But it can also be bad when we start to adjust to things that are wrong and we get used to it. I can remember some years ago seeing some of these comic strip sort of characters. I never read the comics, mind you, but I saw them somewhere. And they had these horrific looking space creatures, and you thought, oh, that's stupid. No one had ever looked like that. It's only a few years later that becomes the fashion of people's dress. You know, they really do. So that if some of the people who died, say, 40 years ago came alive today, they'd say, oh, this is like those comic strip characters. You know, all these people that used to get into spaceships and do all sorts of things, which, of course, now they really do. And then some of these brochures that you get stuck in your letterbox advertising the fashions, you say, oh, that's... people don't really look like that. And it's not long before they do start to look like it. And, I better be careful not to say what I think someone look like it. Someone might think I'm talking about them. But it does happen that quite inadvertently we start to follow the fashions of the world. And really, what we've got out there now is a lot of people who are purely and simply animal. All of the advertising is aimed at this. Now, what effect does that have upon Christadelphian young people? Well, we say, well, we're not like the world. Well, generally, we're not. But very often, we're just a little bit less than, or just a little bit behind them. We've got to forget about the world out there, and particularly in talking to a group of young people like this, this is vitally important. Now, I am not suggesting for one moment that you've all come to a school here so that you might find some partner in life. Those things do sometimes happen. But the thing is this, what we are very interested in is putting on youth gatherings, putting on fraternal activities, where brethren and sisters, notice I said brethren and sisters, I'm not talking about unbaptized young people. Okay? I make the point. Our first important step in life is to determine whether we're going to be united to Christ. not united to some other male or female, depending which particular gender we are. Our number one decision is Christ, okay? Having made that decision then, we mix in an environment where we enjoy this, a mental relationship between a group of people. It will happen, perhaps, in God's mercy, in God's wisdom, that in the course of this, we find another person with whom we have some mental affinity in the truth. It's usually because of two reasons. One, they think the same way as us about the principles of the truth, but they see it from a different point of view. In other words, they complement us. I don't mean they believe a different set of doctrines. They believe exactly the same, but they are able to see it from another point of view. I'm looking at an overhead projector. It's an overhead projector. You're looking at that overhead projector. Still an overhead projector. Can you tell me what brand it is? You can't. You see, you need me to help you, because from here I can see that it's a brand called, I don't know, THD. All right? So we've looked at the same subject, but we were able to help each other. Now that, of course, is why the woman was created on a different basis from the man. And you know what we rubbed out there previously, don't you? She was made with a bias towards the more emotional aspects of the character of God, so that she was able to be that complement to the man and to evoke, draw out, that latent capacity of emotion, mercy, goodness, all of those things, which if that man was the only being upon the face of the earth, he could never learn what mercy and long-suffering and all that was about, except in a purely abstractly moral way. But to come back to our negative lesson, where are we here? We go to Bible schools, we go to youth weekends, we go to youth gatherings, we mix with people. This is what we're interested in, all right? The thing is that the movement from that stage to that stage can be very subtle. Sometimes you don't know it's happening. Sometimes you find that you are searching out a person. And I mean, it doesn't have to be male and female in that sense. I mean, in this sort of area here, we can be talking about an affection and an affinity between brethren and brethren, sisters and sisters, in a very beautiful sort of way. And you find that you're looking forward to seeing someone because you just love talking to them about the things that you have in common. Well, let's hope it's not just motor cars or new dresses or babies or whatever, all of which are essential in themselves, but that it's the truth. And when this happens, then the inevitable result seems to be that it becomes an emotional thing. And then someone says, oh, I hear that so-and-so is going with so-and-so, or something like that. And maybe the two so-and-sos themselves don't even realise it. Very often other people know before they do. That is, if they're starting from this end and working in this direction. Right? But what about the world? The world says, oh, forget about all that nonsense. That doesn't exist. God doesn't exist. The Bible doesn't exist. The Bible's only a set of restrictions. In fact, marriage is the only thing we're looking for, and come to think of it, that's a bit of an encumbrance as well. So let's get rid of marriage. So we're just left with a world of animals, without even the restriction of law nowadays. That's virtually gone. So we come out of a world where we're working, going to school, doing all sorts of things, and all we're hearing all day is this. And we come to youth weekends to try and flush out our brains, cleanse it out with the washing of water by the word, to remind ourselves that this is what God put us on the earth for. Some of us may never, this side of the kingdom, develop this relationship. But so, the Lord Jesus Christ did not. The Apostle Paul did not. Others did not. It's not essential for this. If in God's mercy he sees fit, or in God's wisdom, I should say, sees fit to give us this relationship, then as the Apostle Paul says, it's still counterbalanced because you have added responsibilities, but there are advantages. And so, you see, all of us will be given sufficient for our need. But this is the thing that worries me very much, and it worries a lot of other people. You go to a youth weekend and you see it starting here. You see two people who've never met each other before, and the next thing, they're walking around within a matter of hours, their arms wrapped around each other. Brother Thomas is going to, in the next section, talk about the propensities of the flesh. He says the propensities are blind. And once you say, this is what I'm interested in, then those things just go out the window. And the danger is you could end up getting married and not realise what sort of mind you're married to. So you see, when we place certain restrictions on our children or on our young people, or we place rules for study weekends or whatever, it's with this intention that mental, moral, physical must be the law of life. You know, it's not only the law of life in a good sense. You're going to do something bad, you do it the same way. You usually think about it, you usually desire it, you usually do it. So you can't just stand still. You're either going in one direction or the other. You're going to steal something, you see it, you desire it, you take it. Achan said, I saw, I coveted, I took. Alright? So, Brother Thomas so powerfully brings that out. As generations of mankind lose their intellectual and moral likeness to the Elohim and fall under the dominion of sensuality, so the sympathy between men and women evaporates into animalism. I have quoted it once or twice before. And that's what he says. So, we are not here to develop the animal man. And I really think it's an appropriate time to finish this, because in our next section, which might seem a rather negative one, we're going to look at the subject of the carnal mind. We're going to see what is the difference between the animal and the human being. Now, just before you do pack it all up, the points that you may or may not have highlighted, just check it. All you have to do is to pick up these points. On page 47, you would have had perhaps three sections coloured in. Alright, something like that. The Elohim are a society rejoicing in the love and attachment. I think I've been through that one twice. Right, you've got it down there, so that's it. And on page 48, perhaps two sections there, and it looks like I've done them, so that would be it. Alright? Now, I really didn't get to 1 Corinthians 11, did I? Let's see if perhaps we can pick that up in the next section, because I would like to deal with the carnal mind, which is the problem. And once we've seen what our problem is, we're usually halfway to solving it. So we'll leave it at that section, Stephen.